what I get pleasure from. I like being there around the kitchen table going, what if, you know, with the writer and the director, and we imagine what could be possible. You know, I love being part of the entire journey, not just the journey of making the work, because by the time you finish making the work, you're only halfway through, but the journey of connecting with the audience, which goes on for years and years. And that's the joy of producing, is that you get to champion great ideas and you get to champion really good writers and directors and see it through.
Welcome to the Act of Storytelling.
We want to debate, investigate, and entertain.
Join us as we challenge the human experience
by speaking to people who impact the world through art.
Chapter 2, Podcast 6, Sue Maslin.
Hi, everybody.
I'm Lauren Bailey.
And I'm Nick Kane.
And welcome to the Act of Storytelling.
We would like to show our respect and acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land, of elders past and present, on which this podcast recording today takes place.
Yes. Here we are again, Nick.
Yeah, it's our Christmas podcast. Can we say that?
Yeah, we can say that. That's a bit crazy. I actually was hoping to sit down to listen to where we were at last Christmas, because I feel like I'm in some ways in a similar situation, but quite a different place, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's nice to be able to listen to the podcast that we were a year ago or 2 years ago now, because we've done quite a few now, Lauren Bailey.
We can chart our prehistory of, well, you can't have prehistory. Tell me about the prehistory of your month.
Prehistory of my month. So this month, I think last time we spoke, I was basically getting ready for a move to Newcastle. That move has happened.
Yay.
Somewhat. Yeah, well, somewhat. You know, I'm kind of in a house at the moment. And I think that probably relates to my month's topic, which is around the idea of letting dust settle. So this point, and I'll throw it to you first, Lauren Bailey, this idea of stability in your home location. How much do you reckon that affects you, your work and your focus?
Oh, I think it's huge. Mm. I love living where I live. I've been there for quite some time and it's a real sanctuary for me, and I do a lot of work there, and I rely on being able to come home there and switch off and feel inspired by my surrounding. I think about it a lot. It's huge to me.
It is huge. It is huge. And so that's one of the things I think that I'm at the moment just waiting for it to happen, is this allowing the dust to just settle and get my new house in Newcastle feeling like a sanctuary, feeling like it's a place where I can focus and relax.
Well, you are allowed to give yourself more than a week.
Yeah, no, totally, totally. But, you know, it's like when you move constantly, as I have over the past few years, it's always really hard to just define where those roots sit, if that makes sense.
So
that has been once again happening to me this month. But along that process as well, there's been some really lovely things going on. So I was lucky enough to be an MC host for Disney Australia for their latest conference, which was amazing, you know, amazing talent. You know, they had things like performances by the cast of Aladdin, the musical, and just some really wonderful creators as well. Like even the creator of the Paolo Sebastian label, who's a fashion designer. They're just talking about his connection to his creative process and how Disney's inspired that.
I can imagine that would be a great energy just to have the opportunity to be part of for
amazing.
A day or a couple of days too.
Yeah, really amazing. So that was really lovely to get down to Melbourne and be involved with that, as well as a couple of auditions. So, you know, there's been a couple of, some smaller but some bigger, and you know, it depends how you look at it, I know, but multiple
there
auditions.
There are no big auditions.
There are no big auditions. You're exactly right, Lauren. I corrected myself on that. But there's been a couple of auditions too. So it's been whilst somewhat of a scattered month where the dust is kind of in the air, things have been moving slowly and progressing. As you know, from the past 3 or 4 months, things slowly starting to build as the months go on. So that's been my month.
That's really interesting. And certainly at this time of year, because we do, by the very nature of our calendar and the fact that it's summer in Australia, we do build to the end of the year. Mm. And this is the thing I've been thinking about, because I'm sure last year that was quite a bit of pressure for me, and I remember not necessarily handling it as well as I wanted to be handling it at that time. And I was really looking forward to Christmas week to just stop, which I am still looking forward to. Yeah. But my topic, I suppose, for this month has been continuity and this sense of wherever you're at, continuing with things with a positive mindset. And what was I listening to? Oh, her name's Renee Giarrusso. She's written a book called Limitless Leadership. I was present at a talk that Renee was doing recently about leadership, and she talked about this idea of time management.
Mm-hmm.
We actually can't manage time.
Yeah.
We can only manage ourselves.
I think I've seen this, this talk, this particular talk. We should look this up because I have seen this. I was going to post it on the podcast Facebook. Yes, because it's all around time management and how you can't manage time. And, I think it was telling the story of painting a house actually too. We need to look this up. Yeah. I'll find the clip because I was going to post it.
This is amazing. Yeah. So obviously I saw her do a talk this week on leadership, and I'm actually reading her book at the moment.
Yeah.
So many great takeaways from it. But another one was this idea that if you're ever feeling anxious or nervous, I thought this is perfect for auditions, that it's not possible to feel grateful and nervous or anxious at the same time. It's not scientifically not possible. So if you feel nervous or anxious and you decide to think about something that you're grateful for, that will counterbalance that feeling. So she said that. I'm like, I'm so going to test this out. I mean, gratitude is obviously a big focus for me anyway.
And I think one of her other talking points that I think is worth noting that you have said to me multiple times over this past month is the idea of, that you choose what you want to do. And her big thing was around painting a house, if I remember this clip correctly, which is very pertinent to me right now as I'm painting a house. But the idea that people go, I don't have time to paint the house. So, 7 or 8 hours to paint a room is too long. But then if something goes wrong in your house, like the water leaks, you find that time, that 7 or 8 hours. You choose to find time to do the things that you want to do.
Or maybe you choose to hire a painter, which I think is your lesson.
That is my lesson for everyone. Don't do it yourself. Hire a painter.
But it is great to hear that. I feel, again, our months have sort of aligned nicely. I've had, I know we just said there are no big auditions, but a really positive audition in the last couple of weeks, finished Cuckoo.
Yes.
And came off the back of that show feeling so enriched and so creative that energy really propelled me into the other creative projects that I'm working on at the moment.
Mm.
And as I've mentioned a few times, quite a bit of writing. We have done the next draft of the short film that we are working on.
Exciting.
And it's just been a really positive month. And this theme of continuity, I want to keep this with me throughout the month. Yes, Christmas is coming. Yes, Christmas week is coming. Mm-hmm. Yay. But I am just continuing to do the fantastic creative things that are part of my life. So although there's this build to the end of the year, time off for a lot of people, holidays, all of that, and that it can feel like a break.
Yeah.
I am just focusing on feeling like things are continuing in a really positive way.
Yeah, beautiful, because I think there is a slight difference in the positions for us this month in regards to you're looking for that continuity, and I'm yearning for that, and I think it will come. But the beauty, so I think the topic is continuity for us both.
Don't steal my topic.
I am going to steal it, because you know what? Continuity is the topic of the month, and in that frame of mind, let's continue with another great storyteller that we have for you this month. So please enjoy the interview with one of Australia's most successful film, television and digital content producers, Sue Maslin. Well, welcome to the podcast, first of all, Sue. It's great to have you here. In preparation for the podcast interviews, what we normally do is we start by just asking the storyteller a little bit about what drives them in their career. You shared with us at the start of this that I guess your defining passion is to engage and empower audiences with ideas that matter. Having said that, is there a moment in your career where you feel like you've actually really ticked that box?
Really, it began with the very first film, a documentary film, which was about a gap in Australia's history, and this was about women who had worked on farms for the war effort during the Second World War. They were called the Women's Land Army. They had the word army in their name, but they actually weren't, which meant when the war finished, they were said, look, thanks, that's fine, but look, you go back to being wives and mothers, and actually you're not really an army. You don't have a place on Anzac Day. You're not a service. You can't march with the other service people. You don't get any post-war benefits. You don't get any repatriation, nothing. It was Thanks and Goodbye, which was the title of the film. So firstly, it mattered to me as a feminist woman that here was a story about a group of women who'd made a considerable effort, and most people had no idea what they'd done or what their story was. And moreover, those women, by and large, had not had the opportunity to tell their story to anyone. And at that point, you know, since the war effort, it was like 40 to 50 years for a lot of those women. And it mattered because in making a documentary film as opposed to writing an academic paper or writing a book where you might just get to a few hundred people or a few thousand people at most, when you realise you have access to broadcast television, and in our case, ABC television, not only can you tell that story, but you can actually make significant change through telling that story. And I'm really proud to say that in the making of that film, when we first went to the War Memorial and said, show us your collection on the Women's Land Army, and they went out the back and they literally, and I'm not joking, came back with something the size of a shoebox. And they said, this is all we have, which was pretty much nothing. But they said, look, we would love it to have a collection. We want to know this story. Let's work in partnership. And they did. They funded us. You know, we spent 2 years. We travelled all over Australia. We met women who'd been involved in every aspect of food production and wool production, and just, you know, it was an incredible task they did.
Because when you're saying 40 to 50 years, this is nearly like we're coming towards the end of their lives. If they were serving, you know, it's the end of their lives and they've never been recognised for their service.
Well, a lot of these women were in their 70s and some in their early 80s. Yeah. And we were able to not only tell that story and tell it widely, but more importantly, they did get the recognition and they were invited to march on Anzac Day as a direct result
of
that film. So that was my very, very first taste of what it means to be a documentary filmmaker. And, you know, the funny thing is, even more important than the public space of telling that story was to give women the opportunity to tell their own story. That was an incredibly empowering thing for each one of those hundreds and hundreds of women that we met, and then the 91 that we interviewed and transcribed, and then, you know, the 15 that we filmed. The power of telling your own story and somebody just listening.
Yeah.
And I did that for, you know, I mean, with Sue Hardesty, who is my co-writer and director. We did that over, you know, as I say, a two-year period. And by the end of it, I actually found that I couldn't continue doing these interviews because just about every time the woman I was interviewing would end up in tears.
Yeah,
and then finally that kind of distance that you need to have to be a very effective interviewer started breaking down, and then I'd end up in tears, which is not helpful. Useful to anybody. So I had to, you know, pull away from that. So that was something very powerful at the outset. I realised even more so than the actual broadcast of the film, in terms of affecting change. And it did. It changed the lives of those women.
Yeah, and we'd like to go back to this moment when you didn't really have any connection to media. You were working with a community radio station and had a little bit of broadcast experience, and you decided to study film. Can you talk about that moment?
Well, it was a little bit of fate playing a strange hand, because to be honest, I have no idea why I'm sitting here now and no idea how I got to be involved in film and television, really, because my path was as a country school kid who went away to university at ANU to study science so that she could become a vet.
Right.
Or a zoologist.
Yeah, quite a turn.
So that's what I thought my lot was going to be.
Yeah.
And at the end of it all, I just realised that if you're going to have a serious career in science, then you need to know a hell of a lot about a very narrow field. And the thought of spending years of specialisation and becoming an authority in a very small area ran at complete odds with who I was at the time and who I am, which is someone who just wants to constantly discover as much as I can about this world that we live in and how we make sense of it in all of its manifestations. So I had no idea what I was going to do. I truly did not know what I was going to do. I just knew I couldn't drop out. Okay. I did finish my degree. I'd started doing an honours year, and I just thought, I cannot tell my mum that I've dropped out unless I have a serious...
That's a big driving factor sometimes, yeah. Isn't it? Making sure you don't disappoint mum.
That's right.
Although I wonder how many people think, oh, I'll offer an arts career as the alternative.
As the alternative. What did mum say to that?
I actually did start doing an arts degree. Yeah. Like, I actually started doing, you know, philosophy and a whole lot of arts courses just to prolong. And thank you to Gough Whitlam. These are in the days where it was still free university education.
Yeah.
So it did take me about 7 years to finish my degree because I travelled in the middle of it as well.
Yeah.
But anyway, I thought I need a credible alternative. What I know what I'll do, I'll drive out to the campus of Canberra Advanced College of Education, which is now Canberra Uni, and I parked my car and I thought I'm just going to walk into each one of those buildings on this campus until I find something that looks halfway interesting. And I first building I walked into was Building 9, which happened to be the Media Studies building.
Oh, that is amazing.
You know, and there were kind of really cool posters on the wall and film screenings and a photography class. And I just thought, God, this looks pretty cool. I could do this.
We're so glad you didn't walk into the international politics wing or something like that, because we get to benefit from that.
So I did. I just thought, I'll work for the next 6 months and see if I can get into this course. Then I discovered they only took four full-time students.
Four.
And the rest were part-time, and I really wanted to do something full-time. And I got in. I have no idea why, apart from the community radio work I was doing.
Mm. But also this sense of curiosity that must have come across.
Maybe it did. And maybe because I was slightly different. I didn't come from the arts background that everybody else in the course did. Maybe they just thought, oh, well, maybe we'll mix it up a bit and have somebody.
Yeah, and in the same way that if you're applying for one of the drama schools, they like you to have experience and often in another field it could be.
But that training did you, I know that in another interview you've mentioned that your understanding of the language of filmmaking grew exponentially during the time that you were there. And how has it shaped the way that you work now, having that understanding of the language of filmmaking?
It was utterly life-changing. It's like not only finding your tribe, but finding your language.
Mm.
And to discover in this course that dealt with film, television, sound and photography, theoretical and practical, we were introduced to everything from theories of television naturalism through to data, through to, you know, all the great cinematic movements, through to the theory of silence and sound plays. And on top of that, I got introduced to some collaborators who to this day I still continue to work with, most notably being Daryl DeLaura, who is the writer-director that I've now been working with for 35 years.
Yeah.
So to find great people that felt equally as excited about these different media, and to be making work back-to-back. You know, we were shooting 16mm, Super 8, making audiovisual sound plays. It was just non-stop for a whole year.
Wow.
And you made quite a few projects during that time. You were writing, directing and producing.
Well, when I finished the course in 1982, back in those days, you couldn't work unless you had access to the means of production. The cameras were huge, cumbersome affairs. They cost a fortune. The editing suites filled a room. I was in Canberra, for God's sake.
Yeah.
There was no industry in Canberra. So the only way that I could keep working was to align myself with the School of Media Studies at the Canberra CAA, which I did. I became a tutor for 2 years. And that gave me access after hours and on the weekends so I could take out the gear and I could edit. So I used that time to make a lot of work, ranging from rock clips to performance art pieces to corporate videos on heavy trailer trucking braking systems.
Nice.
A documentary for Woden Valley Hospital, work for the Canberra Youth Theatre, you name it. It was just anything that most of it unpaid, but it just gave me the skills and the craft of writing, producing and directing. At the end of that, of course, it gave me a showreel. And that's the most important thing. And this is what I encourage emerging filmmakers now who do have access to not only broadcast quality equipment, but now access to the means of distribution and platforms, is just to keep making work, because then you've got something to show. And that was what actually got me through the door on the very first film, Thanks Girls.
Wow, yeah. So that's the advice, is go and make it. people will see it, essentially.
If you keep making it and it's good, the downside of the scenario now is everybody and their dog is a filmmaker.
Yep.
And it's even more competitive now than it's ever been, precisely because the, you know, the barriers to entry are that much lower. But of course the avenues now, the ways that you can connect with your audience and with communities and build communities through social media are really exciting. So when I meet emerging filmmakers who have, through their own unique voice, and whether they're cartoonists or they're a filmmaker or they're a musician or whatever, they've built up a really big following. It's the following that people take notice of. Yes, the work, but also the fact that the work connects.
Mm. Yeah.
Those two things are really, really critical. I have met people who've suddenly, you know, got more than a million people following them on Instagram or on YouTube,
yeah.
On a platform,
yeah.
And they get offers. Mm. They get opportunities precisely because of that.
More and more so these days, I would have thought, as those channels get more and more powerful.
They get more and more powerful, and also because streaming now and platforms for streaming are becoming so all-pervasive, and web series is on the rise and rise. It's a really, really exciting medium, and there's no reason why talented storytellers who want to work on screen can't be making, you know, crack hot web series that start to get a following. They get notice and then they get many more opportunities. What is so heartbreaking is when I see the graduates and people coming through who think that they are the next Quentin Tarantino and they just need to make that first feature film, and they sink all of their life savings and their parents and friends' money into these what are effectively vanity projects that don't go anywhere because they haven't got the means of connecting with an audience, and they can't get access to distributors. And it's heartbreaking because they get really disheartened. And I think, well, why, you know, why shoot for that at the beginning?
Yeah.
Why not look into this?
Price of entry doesn't need to be that heavy at that point.
Look at
it?
Web series, build your audience, build your following. That's probably the best way to do it.
Yeah.
And then you'll be in a better bargaining position to do your opus.
Yeah, beautiful. I like that. So the next question that we have is actually from one of our listeners. So it's from Jane Miller, who is a writer.
A fantastic
writer. Fantastic writer, actually, too. Yes, you're exactly right. So her question is, you've produced a number of documentaries as well as some big film projects, and you've won awards for both. Road to Nil was the winner of 2003 Best Feature Film at the Thessaloniki International Film Festival. Not easy to say. But Japanese Story won the 2003 AFI Award for Best Feature Film, and Hunt Angels won the 2006 AFI Award for Best Feature Documentary Film. From the perspective of engaging and empowering audiences with ideas that matter, do you feel that documentary or fiction is more likely to achieve this? And what are you looking for in those early stages of deciding on a project to fulfill that need?
I think every idea has its own shape and its own ultimate way that it needs to be told. It's almost if the story really kind of needs to dictate. If we look at something like Hunt Angels, which is yet another missing gap in Australian history, this time the mythology that sat around the idea that after the heyday of the incredibly successful silent film era that we had in Australia, which pretty much ran right through until the 1930s and then collapsed with the advent of sound and, more importantly, the takeover by the Hollywood studios, who muscled into Australia and shut down all the cinemas unless they would screen the imported studio Hollywood content. So that's another story. We'll come back to that.
Good.
Podcast two.
But we did have a big industry and it was killed, and it can be killed again, so we do need to take note of this. We lost it entirely until the late 60s, when young filmmakers of the day really agitated to have an Australian voice and an Australian cinema industry. And then in 1971, we saw the rebirth of the Australian film industry, with, you know, bipartisan government support ever since then. So here's a missing gap. And in the middle of this, we've always been told that there was no Australian film industry, pretty much in those intervening years. But while there was no film industry, there were filmmakers that continued to make movies.
Yeah.
And in particular, these two characters, Rupert Kathner and Alma Brooks, who were kind of like Bonnie and Clyde. they were scammers.
Yeah.
And they begged, borrowed, stole, whatever means, in order to make movies. And they made four feature films and more than 20 documentaries, and nobody knows anything about their story. So how do you begin to tell a story when, in fact, a lot of what they've done is missing?
Mm. Yeah.
There's nothing in the history books. They're not alive. Nobody really, you know, has any kind of records of these guys. So you think, well, maybe you go a feature film possibly, but then it's a pretty tough premise because no one's heard of them to sell this idea. Mm. Or you do a documentary drama. Documentary is going to be virtually impossible because there's no archival footage or, you know, archival material of these two people apart from a very few photographs and their police records, and that was about it. So we did a hybrid. So you think, well, let's fictionalise to the extent we'll have actors playing Rupert and Alma, and we had the wonderful Ben Mendelsohn and Victoria Hill. And well, let's put them into the world of 1930s, 40s Australia, and we'll do that by sort of CGIing them into a 3D rendering of the 2D photographs. So, yeah, technically it was sort of quite an interesting task.
Yeah.
Shot the whole film in black and white so we could just seamlessly flow in and out of archival footage and black and white photos where our actors are inserted into that world and then recreations. And that became the best way to tell that story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some films, the story is best to be told as straight documentary.
Yep.
And then others really scream to be told as a cinema feature.
And was it a case of you coming across that story or someone brought that idea to you? The very first genesis of the idea?
Very first genesis of the idea is that the writer-director, Alec Morgan, walks into my office and says, I've got
and
something.
And says, I'm looking for Building 9.
Yeah.
He says, I've got
you
something.
You found the right place, yeah.
You found the right place. In fact, that's it. We should change the name of the
name.
Company. Building 9.
Yeah, correct. Building 9's great, yeah.
Place of unexpected opportunity. Alec walked into my office. I'd never heard of Rupert Kathner, had no idea. And showed me some materials that he'd put together in the form of a graphic novel, actually. Because Alec, who's a really beautiful illustrator, knew that he needed to try and tell this story in this particular hybrid way. So he'd done a set of storyboards, which were just stunning, and then showed me. He'd spent the last sort of 3-4 years before that researching, and he had found fragments and references to films, so he was able to show me what he'd found at that point. And I was just fascinated by these two characters and their stories, so we teamed up to do that. And
it sounds like a very technical, like a mixture of story and technical, by the way that you ended up shooting it, right, too. So how do you also marry that idea of I've got a lot of technical, I guess, limitations and that I have to look after.
Technical opportunities,
really. I like that. Always positive.
Because I've been in the business now for 35 years, I've seen a lot of change in the technology.
Yeah.
And every time there's a change, I get excited by the possibilities as they may enhance the way you want to tell a story.
Yeah.
A lot of people get excited by the technology itself,
yeah,
the bells and whistles. Like we're seeing this again. I was around in the early 2000s when we first saw the beginning of digital media, and there was a lot of hype around that and what it may or may not do, which is now sort of transformed into the world that we currently live in. We're now going through it again, with virtual reality, and it's the new shiny thing, and everybody's sort of jumping into it. I have found that a lot of the people who leap into technology are excited about the technology itself and not particularly interested in story. So you do end up in these strange relationships with tech heads that I discovered on one of the projects, and I have done about 4 interactive websites now. But on one of the projects, which was about the hidden meanings of fairy tales called Reenchantment, I only discovered about 3 years into the project that our senior digital technical advisor had never read the script. And he said, why would I read the script? I'll look at, the blueprints for the design and I'll look at the specs, and we've sort of laid out our content management system and I work with that. I don't need to read the script. I was like, wow.
Yeah.
So the motivation is different to the kind of motivation of filmmakers. But I do find it exciting every time that there becomes new tools, new things to play with. And I know that even on something as recent as The Dressmaker, it was really, really exciting to see how the technology had shifted in the years between making that film and Japanese Story so substantially that going out on location hunting with somebody like Don McAlpine, who again has been in the business for a very long time, he had his iPad there. He could actually get exact correct camera ratios, or screen ratio, I should say, and camera lens. So we were able to, right on the spot, see what he was going to be seeing through the camera.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And in real time have that in terms of how it was going to be lit, how it was depth of field, all of that. You know, that was just one out of hundreds of tools that we get to work with now.
So, yeah, technical opportunities. Mm. I'll write that down, not limitations, Lauren.
Obviously, a lot of these projects take a lot of time and a lot of energy. Mm. In one of your papers, Truth and Telling Stories, you say that in your experience, the journey for a documentary to reach the screen is between 2 and 5 years, and for a feature film, at least 7 years. The bulk of the work is unpaid, and there's constant risk that the project will never raise its finance, or even, having been made against all odds, reach its audience. Has there been a project that you've worked on where you've got to the point of not knowing how to move forward or whether to move forward, and how did you get past that moment?
I have a starting premise that every project I've ever worked on and ever will work on will be rejected. It definitely will be rejected. Every project I've ever worked on has been at least once, mostly twice, most 3 times, quite a few of them 4 times, and a number of them 5 times. But it doesn't matter because you just have to get through to the 6th or 7th or 8th opportunity because you only need a small handful of people to say yes.
Yes.
You know, the reject folders on every project are really, really substantial, and I don't take them personally. I try and learn whatever it is that I can from why it's been rejected from that particular door. Mm. You usually don't get second chances in this business. There's no point continuing to knock on that door, but I learn from it when I knock on the next door and the next and the next. So in a situation like The Dressmaker, for instance, it was a really risky proposition. Because, and this is going back now 5 years when I was presenting it to the marketplace and to distributors, they saw it as, well, Sue, you know, it looks like a really, you know, I love the script, great script, you know, it looks like a great project, but very female skewed. And you go, yeah. Mm. Well, female skewed means commercially limited in a lot of quarters because, of course, it's usually the guys that I'm pitching to that don't equate female audience.
Which,
yeah. And it did get knocked back, or it did get offers that were very small, commensurate what they perceived as the risk. Mm-hmm. However, I only needed that one distributor that thought female skewed, yeah, bring it on. Mm. And that was Universal Pictures. It's because they'd had so much success with other very female skewed pictures.
And now that, I mean, we fast forward 5 years, that's a very different conversation I imagine very we're having different. In the room right now.
Very different you conversation know. Now, and I'm really thrilled that The Dressmaker had a big part in changing that conversation. They've, you know, caught on to the fact that with cinema, the female audience, 35 plus, is one of the few demographics that is actually continuing to grow. Because women, we actually do like going to the movies, and we do like going in groups and with each other and with friends and family. That is actually a lucrative market, but it was not perceived as such. If I look at Hunt Angels, this was hilarious. The very first time we pitched it to ABC, and they said, yeah, sure, come up for a meeting. And I flew up to Sydney, met up with Alec, who was up there at the time. We went off to the ABC offices in Harris Street, sat down with the commissioning editor of Arts, and she said, well, we're not commissioning this film. Basically, this guy's a nobody. Nobody knows about him. He's a nobody. Yeah. Why would we want this film? No, we're, you know. We looked up the history books, and he's not even in them. And we said, but that's
the point.
That's why we want to make this movie.
That was my whole pitch.
And I could see, oh, my God. So at the same time going through my head was, oh, my God, you could have told me that over the phone. Yeah. I could see Alec just looking devastated, his face, you know. And all I could think of, I've got to get him out of here. Anyway, we literally got out of that office. I shut the meeting down as fast as I could. Yeah. Said, come on, we're going to lunch. And we just went down to Chinatown. caught her breath and I said, come on, we're going back into the building now. Yeah. And we're going to walk around the corridor and we're knocking on the door of David Jowsey, who was another commissioning editor, which we did. And I said, David, look, we're up here in Sydney. I've got to fly back tomorrow. I just thought we'd take the chance to drop in and say hi and tell you about this new project. And he said, yeah, yeah, I've got 5 minutes, sit down. And we told him, and he said, God, that sounds amazing.
Oh.
And, you know, within a few months, we got that film up.
Right.
That's what I mean about the different doors.
You could have stopped at that point when you were having lunch and just gone, we're going back.
Yeah, exactly.
And not taking that personally.
We'll be back with the interview shortly.
And it's Artist Toolkit time. Recently, Nick, I had a conversation with some acting buddies regarding what social media presence it's necessary to have in this day and age as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
So back in the day, you needed to be registered on Showcast. Done. Then came Casting Networks. Then you needed a website. Now you need a Facebook page.
Yeah, and now it's all about how many followers you have on Instagram or Twitter, and if it's possible to hire someone to do all that digital admin for you, which we were talking about the other day, like we need someone to do that for us. So look, we decided to discuss our thoughts on
that. So there's a quick
the
job advertisement right
correct.
There.
Yep. If anyone wants to be my social media manager, please inquire within. So look, we decided to sit down and talk about the matter, and look, hopefully we can give you a little bit of a broader picture of what we tend to use, and as well as throw in some stats that might be powerful and helpful for you as an actor and artist.
Yeah, and obviously with Google at our fingertips these days, you can discover anything you'd like to know about a new unknown, and it makes sense to have a positive online presence.
What we want to do with the Artist Toolkit this month is really talk about what social tools we use. So Lauren, talk to us. Okay. What do you use?
For better or worse,
yep.
I have a website, but not a Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say there's no point having a website, and some people say there's no point having a Facebook page, but they definitely say there's no point having both.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. I 100% agree with that. I think that you should personally have a website. Facebook page, it's really about, are you adding value and quality over quantity?
And I think also maybe a year or so ago on Facebook, yes, Facebook page was a great thing, but now with the algorithms, I'd be interested in more stats on that, but I don't know.
It's no use having a Facebook page if you've got 20 followers and you're posting once a month. Like, it's just not adding any value and it doesn't make you look better as a performer.
Yep.
That's my belief.
Yep. I think Showcast and Casting Networks are essential.
Yep. Agreed.
I have Twitter. Now, ostensibly, this is for reaching out and making connections rather than self-promotion.
Yes.
But I'm not really sure how great I am on the Twitter sphere.
I'm exactly the same. And I think it's the same, Twitter and Instagram. I know that you're a bit keener on Instagram these days. But they're both things. Once again, if you're not creating relevant content and it's not a value add to people, then it's really sitting there being dormant.
And I mean, it's interesting too, because we have Twitter for the act of storytelling, which I quite like.
Yeah.
But then I need to figure out, well, what's my personal voice for Lauren Bailey, the actor, on Twitter separate to that? And that can get muddy.
Messy.
And of course, this thing with Instagram, which I think is growing on me. I had a conversation recently with an agent. Their advice was that as an actor, you absolutely need to have Instagram. Like, I don't know the particular argument points there.
Yeah.
But I guess it's just, the more I try to wrap my head around it, I'm starting to look at things and think, oh, that could look interesting online. But then I'm a total junkie for, you know, layout, where you can take 4 or 10 or 20 photos and mash them all up. And I'm actually not sure that's ideal, but I get really excited and I use layout for everything. So I'm trying to, you know, break that addiction.
Once again, though, and I just challenge it constantly with this, is who is looking at it and where are they finding the value in it?
Yeah.
Things like Instagram. So look, each to their own. That's just my personal view on it. You need to be adding value to people's lives. And as an actor, you need to be right up the tree, I think, for Instagram to be value. Value.
And it's so interesting because I really feel at the moment, I'm like, okay, I need to have these things. So I have them at a surface level.
Yep.
But again, it's that thing of painting the house.
Yes. I love that that's the analogy throughout this podcast.
It all comes back to painting.
Yep.
You know, that it takes time and you need to experiment with them to see what's useful. And again, this term, this idea of value add, and I do think often it's the things I see about other people on there that are useful for me. You can find out things about the industry both through Twitter and through Instagram. And I need to get better at that, how to use them as search tools.
Search tools. And that's an interesting point because backstage expert and casting director Benton Whiteley says that when an actor comes to his attention, the first thing he does is Google them.
Yeah.
And this is a quote directly from him. I go onto Facebook and type in your name and I see what I can learn about you from there. I look you up on Twitter. I look you up on Instagram. I use everything because I need to learn everything about you, which once again goes back to my point is quality over quantity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rather than a picture of you with your mates having a red wine, it's about curating the content so that it doesn't need to be heaps, but he knows that you are out there acting.
And I think that comes back to having a really clear idea of what your brand
Correct.
Is. And I don't know if we focus enough on that in this industry because it's smaller than like a major market like America.
Totally agree.
So I think there's a lot in there. And I do follow Heidi Dean. She's mm-hmm. the Marketing for Actors founder on Twitter. I follow her on
yes.
Twitter. And she believes that platforms like Twitter and Instagram are limitless in their opportunities for connections with industry professionals. Mm. Other courses I've done, How to Get More Auditions with Greg Apps. He's a big fan of touching is his term on Twitter. But it's actually a really, really great advice and he covers that a lot in his course, how to reach out in a thoughtful way and make connections rather
yes.
than hassling people.
Yes.
And also Bonnie Gillespie, who I've done some coaching work with over in America.
Mm-hmm.
She advocates having Twitter, but just being on there and just seeing what people are doing. Just you don't have to post anything. Just being on there and seeing what's going on.
Yeah. I think one other person that I just want to highlight here, one of my personal favorites on Facebook is a guy named Glenn Carlson.
Yeah.
He talks from the entrepreneur space, but I think it's relevant to what we as actors do. And he says, the moment you begin to attract people that like you, that have never met you, that follower one person removed from you that thinks you add value to their life, that's when you become a key person of influence. That's when you become a key person of influence. So not your friends, not your family. When there's someone removed from your friendship group, if they think you're adding value, that's when you start to become what they call an influencer. So when you look at your Facebook page, when you look at your Instagram page, do you have those people? And if not, is that then a relevant channel for you to use?
Yeah, and then that brings up questions for me because it's this idea of taking control of the stories that you're telling. So through the podcast and through In Life Today and through the social pages for those, I often feel more confident sharing something that I feel adds value through the angle of a story rather than through the angle of Lauren Bailey. But then again, maybe that comes back to not understanding enough, needing to understand more my voice as a storyteller. Anyway, I think we could go on for ages, but I would be interested. I mean, we haven't even touched on YouTube, and I would like to say I'll put a link to The Ultimate Guide to Social Media for Actors by Stage Milk on the website because they've got a great section on how to hashtag and the view that the hashtag actors life should never, ever be used. It's really interesting and did make me laugh.
That's so true.
Maybe guilty of doing that. But if people are interested in us talking more about this, there are a few people that we could get on the podcast. So let us know if this is useful to you.
Really powerful stuff. Back to the interview.
So you're president of the Natalie Miller Fellowship, a member of the Gender Matters Task Force, and a recipient of the Jill Robb Award for Outstanding Leadership Achievement and Services to the Victorian Screen Industry. And you've been campaigning for over 20 years for women in the film industry, particularly off the back of the stories you've just told us. Do you feel that things are changing? I sometimes feel like we do a lot of work. I feel quite positive that the gender parity conversation is being had, but then I'll speak to someone who has heard nothing about it and I never know if anything is actually shifting or it's just my awareness.
I think it will take time. I genuinely believe that we're in a watershed moment right now and having, as you say, been around for 25 plus years where I've seen many, many efforts trying to redress the gender imbalance, many affirmative action programs, funding programs, cultural awareness, all of which never shifts anything. Right now, I think there is going to be an opportunity for a genuine shift, and that's for a few different reasons. One is the most obvious and pressing one right now is the issue of accountability. And whether, the sexual harassment campaigns and the Me Too campaign and the public awareness now of the systemic gender power imbalance that's led to abuse at its worst extreme end through to limited opportunities or shutting off of opportunities for women. It's a continuum that's been allowed to persist for a long, long time, but we've come to a moment in history where we're saying, actually, it's enough. You can't put the door on that. You cannot go back from the demand that is being made and the avenues that make it safe for women to come forward and demand accountability. And social media's had a very big, big part in all of this, which is amazing. So that's been a big change. The second big change that's happened is that right at the minute, we're in the middle of disruption across all of our media channels. And that disruption means that the old business models are collapsing around us. And we here in Australia have got away with heritage media a little bit longer than most because we've got such crap, you know, internet and internet speed, and the NBN ain't going to deliver.
And so disruption, you mean our media sources that we are looking
to? I mean disruption in the way that we produce, that we finance, and that we consume media. Mm-hmm. All of it's changed profoundly.
Gotcha.
And the heritage media of cinema and television and so on, the business models have, you know, by and large been under extreme pressure and in some ways collapsing the kind of revenue streams that used to finance the way we made screen programs has changed really, really profoundly. So that has meant that there are opportunities now for rethinking how we go about financing and making it work and reaching audiences. And the technology has delivered up a whole lot of new platforms, i.e. streaming services. We've seen Hollywood pretty much stop making movies about 5 or 6 years ago and now just makes brand exercises, franchises, sequels, prequels, you know, whatever. But the storytelling has shifted now into streaming services. If you want really, really good storytelling, you go to Netflix or Amazon or Hulu or to find long-form drama series that deliver the kind of quality actors, writers, direction that we used to see in our cinemas. That shift is throwing up opportunities for women. If you look at the Emmys this year, the award-winning dramas were going to programs that were written, produced, or in some cases directed by women. Yeah. So, you know, shows like The Handmaid's Tale, Big Little Lies, Transparent, I mean, these are game changers. They are showing the business end of town as well, that women actually can be making, you know, highly rating and very profitable shows, and that audiences want to see these stories because they're not being told anywhere else.
Yeah, and the perspective is different. So this question that I think that comes up with you a lot, and you've quite clearly defined this in some of your papers, is this idea of women in positions of leadership in the industry. So when we look at that idea of leadership, who are the people we're talking about? Are we talking about top of the tree, see, like, what is your definition of those particular roles?
Yeah, look, I've really come to the conclusion that nothing will change unless we have strong leadership at the table of the gatekeepers, the people who greenlight programming, and that can be greenlit at the financing stage, i.e. deciding what gets made, and then secondly again, who decides what gets onto the screen, because that's another filter. And at both of those critical stages, they're overwhelmingly men who make those decisions. Very, very few women are engaged, for instance, as cinema programmers, deciding what goes on the 2,000 plus screens around our country at the moment. There are less than 5 women involved in that. Television, you know, in the public broadcasters, definitely women are engaged very highly in programming, but not so much on the commercials. And at the finance, if you follow the money, it's almost invariably controlled by men. We need to find ways of getting more women at the table and in these critical roles and changing the culture of these media organisations, changing the perception or the world view of what will and will not work for audiences, changing an appreciation just for who makes up our audiences. I mean, the insanity of all of this around cinema, for instance, is that the data has been around for years that shows that films that have a female protagonist actually outperform films that have a male protagonist by the factor of around 15%. And films that have a female and male protagonist together will outperform by 23%. films that'll have a male protagonist. This data, which is all in my most recent paper, has been around for a number of years, but it's not shifted the culture because, by and large, it's a very risky business and the men who control the money feel more comfortable about giving that money to people that they perceive as less risky, which is guys. So we have to shift that, and I am very, very hopeful that we're in a time where this shift now is looking to become increasingly possible, and at the heart of it is because of generational change.
Yep.
Thank God the baby boomers, myself included, are going to be moving on. In the next 5 years or so, we're getting out of the way.
Yeah.
5 to 10 years, and there will become more opportunities for younger people. We want to make sure young women are in that mix.
I find that amazing that this has just fallen on deaf ears for such a long amount of time that now... But this is the question I still have. What is it about now? Is it the baby boomer? What is it about now that's changing things and finally shifting things if this data's been around for years?
It has. I hope it does reach far and wide because there have been a number of filters in place that have systemically meant that the total number of directors working in this country, only 16% are women. Of the total number of writers, it's about 23%, and the total number of producers are 32% women. Those figures have not shifted now for like 20 years or more. They will shift because opportunities will be given, but those opportunities will not be given unless you've got more women who are in a position of leadership to be able to provide those opportunities. Yeah. We know that works because, I mean, I've done the research certainly for the 5-year period up until 2015, and I just asked the question, well, when women are given the opportunity to direct, who's giving them that opportunity? And it's overwhelmingly more than 90% women producers will give a woman director the opportunity to direct. Male producers don't.
Comes back to your gatekeepers idea, doesn't it?
Yeah,
and changing the gatekeepers.
That's how we've got to change things. The Screen Australia theory, I think, is a good one in the sense of, well, let's try and force the opportunities by flooding the pipelines with developing more content from women. But it should be seen as a positive market opportunity. And I think it might be a little bit now because it's not only Universal Pictures, it's all of the distributors are falling over themselves right now to find the next dressmaker, to find the next lion, to find the next big movie that's going to appeal to women.
So I feel like this is a great time to touch on Harvey Weinstein and Don Burke for that matter. Specifically, I want to refer to Britt Marling's article that she wrote, Harvey Weinstein and the Economics of Consent. And she talks about how she found herself auditioning for parts that seemed largely about seeking male approval, that the stories themselves were narratives that she didn't necessarily politically or morally agree with, and that the only way she felt like she could take her power back and find her way through Hollywood with any sense of agency was to become a storyteller herself. And I wondered, in terms of this idea of taking power back at an individual level and things we can change for ourselves, if you have any advice for women in the arts industry in how they can navigate their path or maintain power in the Australian arts industry?
The first thing I'd say is don't attempt to do it at an individual level. And I think Britt, together with people like Reese Witherspoon and many other powerful women in Hollywood, have only been able to do this because they're doing it as part of a network, usually of other women who support them. So the first thing I'd be saying, yes, find a way to have agency in telling your story, but make sure you do it as a collaboration. Make sure you team up with others who are going to really support you and give you the best opportunity to develop that voice, and also to withstand the inevitable kind of rejections and difficulties that are going to come your way. So that would be the first thing. Look, if we just, again, go back to this idea of this, systemic, power imbalance that's led to the abuses and the sexual harassment and the bullying, the aspects of our culture that have been around for a very, very long time. Women, we've all known about it. Men, we've all known about it. Yet all of us have allowed it to survive. All of us allowed it through a compact, if you like, a complicity for different reasons. Obviously, you know, men, because it worked to their advantage pretty well for a long, long time. It's catching up with them a bit now, but it certainly was no onus upon them to shift the culture. But for women, the silencing was to do with the economics. It was to do with the shame. It was to do with the fact that when you've been through it, you literally can lose your voice, totally, like physically lose your voice, let alone just on an emotional level. It takes years to find the courage to be able to firstly name it, even to your inner circle, let alone to yourself, and then to take the next step and actually want to bring somebody to account. So I believe that we're probably only at the tip of the iceberg at the moment. There's certainly a hell of a long way for all of this to play out, and even here in Australia, a long way for it to play out. But one of the most empowering things I think that's happened is that through Tracy Spicer just saying to women, look, in this first instance, you do not need to go public. We've got a closed group here. You can just write to me personally, and just to start to support. Build an environment that was safe, an environment in which women were heard, and an environment in which, if women wanted to, could take it further, knowing full well that if they were, you know, naming a particular individual, chances are that individual had played out that behaviour with a lot of other women, and that's exactly how this has unfolded, that becomes a game changer. I just keep thinking, you cannot put the lid on this again.
Mm. Yeah. It's just, the dam has broken, hasn't it? And I guess one last question before we do move on to other things, but just the male voice in this. What's the advice? I've spoken a lot about the female voice in that. What is the advice to the males out
there? We need male champions. We need men who will listen, men who will just treat women with respect. Men can get very twisted and tormented by this idea of what can I do then? You know, what sort of behaviour? Look, at the end of the day, we all know what is involved if we just treat people respectfully. Yeah. And if men are deeply, deeply confused, and you just think, well, think of somebody that's higher up in the hierarchy than you are, a woman that's higher up in the hierarchy, whatever particular area you might be in, how would you behave towards them? Okay, well, how about applying that to women who are your colleagues or women who are working for you in terms of that level of respect? We all know where there's a line there. Whether something there is a mutual consent or a mutual attraction or whatever, or whether it's because of a power imbalance that a line is being crossed, and just use your common sense. And, you know, surely men have got as much common sense as women in all of this.
Yeah. But it's about, as well, what you were saying there as well, is the voices from the male camp, they need to be there as much as the voices from
I think
the
they're even more important. Yep. I quote, certainly the writing that I've done, I love reading examples of where men have just been outstanding in thinking about how to support women. And, you know, write down for someone like Ryan Murphy, for instance, who, you know, is the writer and creator of Glee and so many other, you know, brilliant series. And he just kind of sat down one day and just said, well, it's crazy that we just should have half. You know, there should be half of all writers, half of all directors, half of all technicians on any show that I'm producing. Let's do this. And then he inevitably got the pushback saying, oh, well, there's just not enough women grips and women gaffers or women technicians. He just said, train them.
Yeah.
Train them. And he's stuck by this commitment to half. Here is another story that I just love. Earlier this year, I was executive producing a web series, Other People's Problems, which actually kicks off today on ABC iView.
Yeah.
We had pretty much, it was largely a female crew, including two female directors of photography.
Yeah.
And Miranda, who ran one of our two cameras, was telling me the story of how she got her first break. And she was working with a wonderful DOP here in Melbourne called Laszlo Branier. And they were on a shoot, which was a two-camera shoot, A camera, B camera. They'd started work, you know, week one, at the end of the first week. Laszlo got hauled into the producer's office, and who sat down and sort of said, oh, we're not happy with the work on B camera. Not happy. And then Laszlo sort of said, oh, I'm really, really sorry with the quality of my work. I've been doing this for a long time. Is there something particular I'm not doing right? This really clever guy had taken the precaution of putting Miranda, his acolyte, onto A camera. And he ran B camera.
Wow.
Just precisely so this sort of thing wouldn't happen. Anyway, needless to say, they both kept their jobs, and she's a terrific cinematographer now.
That's fantastic. Story,
yeah. So I just go back to, we need men now more than ever, more than ever, to step up and be part of addressing this gender imbalance.
And just to confirm too, your release date is December 4th, because by the time this goes live, just confirming, it'll be out, available. It'll be out for a while.
And if you haven't already watched it, listeners, you're wasting your time. Yeah. What are you doing?
Oh, look, it's good fun. It's all about female friendship and the lost art of letter writing.
Fantastic. We're getting towards the end of the interview now, but there is a one person that we haven't mentioned that I'm sure has been one of your major collaborators over your life, and you have already touched on it briefly. That's Daryl DeLauro, who is the co-founder of Film Art Media. You're a rights management, development and distribution company, and you run that with Daryl, who you've worked together for over 30 years, which is quite amazing. So what qualities in Daryl do you see, and do you think that are important in a collaborator? And also, I want to go right back. Like, was it back in the days of studying in Canberra that you met Daryl, and what was that first meeting like?
Yeah, no, it did. We were film students together, and we would do all-nighters together with our collaborator, Ian Wansborough, who has been a co-writer on many of the projects that Daryl and I have done together. So, yeah, it goes right back to the beginning, I think, because I knew virtually nothing about film, of course.
Yeah.
But Daryl did. He had come from an arts background at Monash. He was a big lover, in particular of political, you know, documentaries and also noir cinema.
Yeah, right.
And one of the very first things we ever did together is made a 16mm film noir that was so noir because we underexposed it by two stops. You can't see anything in the
very
film.
Very moody.
But we made that movie, and
Neo-noir.
It was called ETD, Estimated Time of Departure.
I love it.
And it cemented that we just love working together, and we've been working together ever since. And it is good collaboration in the sense that I, fairly early on in my career, worked out that people who are really good at writing and directing, you know, have a skill that I hugely admire but don't need to emulate. Yeah. And I've worked with some of the best writers, Jocelyn Morehouse, Ann Turner, Alison Tilson, Sue Brooks. Daryl, Alec Morgan, like just really, really good writers and directors in many cases. And the thing that I was really good at was making things happen.
Yeah.
And I still am. You know, that's what I get pleasure from. I like being there around the kitchen table going, what if, with the writer and the director, and we imagine what could be possible.
Yeah.
And then I love being part of the entire journey, not just the journey of making the work, because by the time you finish making the work, you're only halfway through, but the journey of connecting with the audience, which goes on for years and years.
Yeah.
So, and that's the joy of producing, is that you get to champion great ideas, and you get to champion really good writers and directors and see it through.
That's a very unique view though, isn't it, too? Because sometimes you see, and I talk about this on the podcast quite a bit, this idea of the creative and the logistical people, and often, you know, especially in corporate Australia, you've got the creative department, you've got the logistical department, and somewhere in between they'd sometimes meet. But it sounds like your role, you very much are blurring those lines in regards to the creative producer, essentially. You really are passionate about the story, and they're passionate about going out and doing it.
Yes, yeah, both.
Does Daryl feel that same way as well, or does Daryl like to
concentrate? Do you
concentrate?
Offset each other?
Yeah.
No, we really complement each other, because Daryl is an incredibly thorough researcher and writer, so he can spend, you know, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. In the case of our recent film, Harry Seidler, you know, that took us over 10 years to get that film up. But he will spend a number of years in writing a really, really good script and has the patience to do that. And then I will obviously be, you know, hopefully providing him with the resources to be able to do that, and tapping into the creative development, looking, reading the scripts, providing feedback and so on. But I'm not going to necessarily be the one that's sitting down for the 2 or 3 years, in the case of feature film, 3 or 4 years, and actually writing the script. So it sort of complements really well for a writer to be working with a producer and vice versa. And if there's a separate director, for them to be in that mix as well. But I have tended to, I must be said, to work with a lot of writer-directors, because I like that combined role.
Yeah.
It's
a bit more agile too, right? Like it's easier in the room when you're meeting to just go, you're looking after that, I'm looking after that, yeah. And we can meet in the middle.
Yeah. But look, creative producing is what I do. I'm driven by ideas and driven by the need to tell stories and connect with audiences, hopefully, about ideas that matter.
And it seems that you have a real passion for and respond really well to changing environments and a certain degree of uncertainty in the artistic climate. But do you have any concrete ideas or any images for short term, what's coming for you next?
Yeah, actually, I just get excited by doing things that I haven't done before or about I have a story I haven't heard before or challenges. And the next big challenge, having said all of that about producing, is that I want to have a crack again at writing and directing a documentary.
Oh, wow.
So I'm going back to where I started, 35 years ago. And it's only because this particular story is something that rather than asking somebody else to write it, it's just something that I thought, yeah, actually, I've spent the last 2 years thinking about it, researching it. And over the next year, I'm going to be writing it up. It was just something I wanted to immerse myself in. And that is, I've been doing a bit of work with Shane Gould, former Olympian, about the idea of the culture of swimming in Australia and why we have this sort of mythology, this belief in ourselves as a nation of swimmers and that it's sort of in our DNA somehow. Yeah. And we project it outward to the world and we present ourselves as a nation of swimmers when in fact most of us don't.
Yeah.
Most of us actually don't swim. And
we are quite successful though, aren't we? Is that like at the Olympics?
Well, we used to be. We get reminded every 4 years we're not quite as successful as we used to be.
We don't have those heroes like we maybe once did.
Indeed. And in fact, these days, unlike when I grew up, there's only two states in this country now where swimming is compulsory amongst kids, and there's less than 50% of kids now who leave primary school actually knowing how to swim.
Really?
Yeah, and there's a whole lot of reasons for it. There's waves of immigration that have, from countries that don't have a culture of swimming. Mm. Swimming is very expensive. It's not publicly available now and freely available at schools. It's, you have to be taught in private lessons mostly.
Mm.
And we don't send kids off down to the pool to muck about in the afternoon anymore. That does not happen. Like, either they're on their devices or their games or they're in air-conditioned houses. They don't have to get away from the heat. Anyway, so that's a massive challenge to be doing this.
Yeah.
And this is the first time I've actually talked about it publicly.
Oh,
wow.
Because
exclusive.
Who knows whether I can get this together or not, but it's a risk. I want to take a creative risk.
Fantastic.
And I'm really excited about being immersed in telling this story. The second thing I know that I don't want to do, and that is jump on the bandwagon that's virtual reality. And I take up my hat to everybody else that wants to do it. But for me, having engaged with new technologies now for 35 years, this is a technology that is at odds with how I see engagement with screen.
Yeah.
And that is, it's a very individualistic space that is being created here that is not about a communal
sharing
necessarily. And I fundamentally think that I want to be engaged in screen work that brings communities together.
Yep.
I've decided that's my cutoff point.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Sue. This has been a really lovely, enlightening chat.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah,
it's been fun talking to you guys.
Really appreciate you coming to talk to us today.
And we look forward to seeing that project when it comes to fruition in a few years.
Indeed.
5 years or so.
No, documentary. Yeah. 2 to 3 years.
Thank you, Sue. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much, guys.
I'm so fired up.
So fired up, Lauren Bailey. Can you tell me what you took out of that?
Well, as per usual, for all the interviews we do, I took a lot of things out of
that
interview.
I love that you say that every month. It's so fantastic.
And now I'm acknowledging that I say it every month.
Yeah.
But in particular, I really like the idea, the way she handles rejection and that she expects rejection and she looks forward to it. Sue factors in that she'll need to knock on 6 or 7 doors and get those no's first and that you don't get a second chance in the industry, so there's no point knocking on a door you've already knocked on.
Yeah, yeah.
But going, okay, what can I learn from that no?
Mm.
And relishing that, continuing to learn and go, okay, what does that tell me about what I need to do now?
Yeah, there's like, a real water off duck's back type attitude, isn't it? Like, that's okay that you said no. Now I'm going to go knock on this person's door over here because they might like it.
And it's not just, it's okay that you said no. It helps me that you said no.
Yeah.
That helps me with my direction for how to get to yes.
To the next, yeah. Love Fantastic. It. I love it. You know what I took out of it? I was halfway through that interview and then I really noticed that I feel like myself and Sue have a very similar approach sometimes to the way that we do things. Yes, she's a creative producer and yes, I might be slightly different creative producer, but I love that she has this logistical side to her, but it doesn't exist without her complete investment in the story.
Yeah.
And that is so important because for many, many reasons, but you know, one particular one is that how can you fully understand the story and give it its best possible birthing if you don't sit in those meetings and go through those creative processes with...
But even from the get-go, doing research for this interview, she talks about how the whole process each time begins with her artistic vision. And when they sat down to watch the Dressmaker premiere in the cinema, that's when she got to see that initial artistic vision come to life. And it's just such a beautiful circle. And if you are that invested at the beginning... Yeah. That's the whole reason.
Yeah, that's the whole reason. So I really love that. I saw these connections and I went, that's fantastic because she's such a successful person in the industry. So it's nice to see those parallels. Goodness gracious, Lauren. That brings us, doesn't it? It really throws us into this next month. Very excited. And what does this next month hold for you?
Oh, I feel like it's a complete gift for this month.
It is.
It's really in line with where I feel I'm at the moment. Mm-hmm. Last month... Sally talked about what's the worst they can do. They can only say no. And I have used that. I've used that over the last month. And now I feel like I have the next building block. Not only can they only say no, if they do say no, that's helping you. And I just feel like it's the perfect time of year to receive that kind of advice. What am I doing? We've already talked about what I'm doing.
You've kind of mentioned that up the front, haven't you? But that makes complete sense.
Yeah, you tell me about your month and then I'm going to recommend a few things because that's where I feel like I'm... What's happening around me, that's where I'm at the moment.
Well, my month, you know, as we come into Christmas, I think that's a wonderful time and I spoke up front about giving time for the dust to settle. The parts of my life are the dust and everything coming into a stability and continuity. A point where you are, if that makes sense, in regards to going, I feel like things are in place and now I can continue and build on. So I think the Christmas time is a wonderful time for that to be happening, to be able to sit down and go, rightio, this is a new beginning. This is a time to really get all those little building blocks into place. So that's really what I'm looking at this next month. I'm not going to kid myself in regards to there's still so much to do domestically as well as, you know, some auditions. I've still got the comedy and I've still got pretty much a script there ready to go. It's just getting off my little backside and getting to an open mic night. Having a little creative space of my own at my house is going to be fantastic and I'm really looking forward to that over this next month. I think this is a wonderful time.
Oh, I should
time.
Say.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm working on a feature film. Fantastic. I'm in a feature film this month.
You really left that one out, didn't you? That would have been good to get up front, I would have thought. I'm doing a feature film.
I'll talk more about that next year. Next year, kids.
In next year, you will. So you've got a couple of recommendations.
Yes, before we get to next year, I recently was lucky enough to be interviewed about... the film In Life Today for a fantastic website called We Are Moving Stories. Now, the aim of the website is to broadcast and embrace new voices in drama, documentary, animation, journalism, music video, and web series.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to pop a link in the show notes, but I wanted to do a shout out to the site founder, Carmela Baranowska, because it's a fantastic platform. And the whole idea of this site is to connect films and filmmakers to their audiences, to other producers and distributors, sales agents, whoever they feel that they need to continue their creative projects that they're working on.
Nothing wrong with that.
Ah, you know, when you come across something, you're like, yes, the heart of that, I really agree with what that's trying to achieve.
Mm.
And it proudly encourages 50% plus women's participation on the platform. So there's lots of... female stories
on there. Strong topic this month, Lauren. Strong topic this month.
You can check that out at wearemovingstories.com.
Fantastic.
And my other recommendation
mm-hmm.
is for fellow Earbuds Network podcast, Quickie.
Mm.
Now, this is hosted by the lovely Nevena Sporovska and is a feminist podcast that celebrates the stories and experiences of dynamic women. I've only listened to a couple of podcasts.
Yes.
And the two I've listened to so far, one is with Australian comedy writer and stand-up comedian Catherine Devaney, who was a regular columnist for The Age newspaper from 2001 to 2010. And another one with Anna Bronowski. I hope I'm getting these names right. The filmmaker behind Pauline Hanson, Please Explain, the 2016 political documentary that explores the history of Australian political figure Pauline Hanson and the One Nation Party and all the controversy surrounding her.
Amazing.
And they're intelligent and they're funny and just like a breath of fresh air. I really, really recommend this podcast. And Nev has a political background and she's a great person.
Great person.
Great person.
There you go.
There you go. You should listen to her podcast because she's a great person.
Quickie. And We Are Moving Stories was the other one, wasn't it? The website We Are Moving Stories. So there are recommendations for this month. Lauren, that brings us to the end of podcast 6 for chapter 2 of The Act of Storytelling. If you are excited about this podcast, as we are, or if you have any feedback, you know we love to hear from you. Twitter at Act Storytelling or via email at theactofstorytelling@gmail.com. And of course, we love you anyway, but we would love you more if you leave us a review on iTunes.
No emotional blackmail there. And remember, if you'd like to help us keep the podcast humming, head on over to patreon.com/theactofstorytelling. And for as little as $1 a month, you can keep up to date with what we're up to and get some great rewards, including a chat with us.
No way.
Who wouldn't like that?
Yeah, that's right. Well, we'll chat to you next month. Continue to join us on The Act of Storytelling.
Thanks for listening.
Melbourne's Podcast Network. Earbudsnetwork.com.